your title again?
Is it rolling, Bob?
Earlier in October, 58 people murdered and more than 500 were injured at a country music festival in Las Vegas. It's the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. And then you have Caleb Keeter, who's a guitarist with the Josh Abbott Band. He was caught in the shooting that night, a country musician. And he said that night changed his mind on gun control. How do you feel about someone like Caleb, a country musician, changing his mind?
I have no problem whatsoever with him changing his mind about it. I mean, I can see, but let me tell you something else. There is a good possibility, and I don't know the young man, so I'm not saying he will or he won't, but it's a good possibility he may change it back again. You know, I feel for anybody who was out there. Was such a kick in the head to the whole industry and people that we all knew, artists that we all knew and people that were playing out there, and it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. I don't blame him at all for changing his mind about gun control if he feels like that gun control would stop what's going on. Here's the situation. I don't know how familiar you are with the laws that we have here in the United States, but the thing about it is we have more laws on the books controlling guns that are not followed, that need to be followed. You look at Chicago, you check for yourself, go to the internet, check the rate of deaths in Chicago by guns. They have the most stringent gun laws in the country. So what difference is one more law going to make?
Well, New York and Los Angeles both have stricter gun laws than Chicago. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but they have stricter gun laws in Chicago, and their homicide rates are far lower. I mean, where are you seeing this information?
I'm reading the I don't know. I'm just what I've read, that they have strict gun laws in Chicago.
I mean, I'm saying that, you know, from what I've been reading, New York and Los Angeles.
Well, they may have. There's a reason that those deaths go on in Chicago. There's a reason for it. There's, you know, if you don't attack the problem, if you're so politically correct that you're afraid to attack the problem, it's nothing going to happen.
What do you mean by politically correct?
Well, you know what I mean by politically correct?
I don't, sir.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. If you don't know, I don't know how to tell you. It's just a mindset that that the politicians in Chicago don't seem to think they can do anything about it. And as long as you feel that way, it's the way it is.
But I bring this up because this is not the first time you veered into politics. I mean, you know, in the book, one of the kind of the more powerful chapters is when you write about the September 11th attacks. You talk about your song, "This Ain't No Rag, It's a Flag." You know, the lines like, "We're going to hunt you down like a mad dog hound." You talk about the reaction that you got to what people perceived as a negative reference to Muslim headscarves. And in your memoir, you write about country music television not wanting to play the song because, again, you say it was politically incorrect. You know, what were you trying to achieve with that song right after September 11?
I was trying to say, if you listen to the lyrics, it says it's going to hunt you down like a mad dog hound. It's because we're talking about the people who bombed the trade towers here in New York where I am. We're talking about the people who killed 3,000 people on September 11th, and that they need to be punished, and it's time to go get them. We knew who did it.
But I think you talk in the book about people hearing that song, and I think a lot of people listening to that song would say that it's it might be Islamophobic, it might be warmongering. Like, well, what would you say to that?
I'd say they can have their own opinion. That's not the way I intended it. I didn't write it with that spirit at all. I did not write the song with the spirit of being Islamophobic or any kind of phobic at all. It is written about justice. That's it.
The reason I bring this up is because it just sounds like there was a change, Charlie. Like, it sounds like there was a guy who was playing with Bob Dylan. There was a guy who you said something really interesting to me earlier. You said Bob Dylan was a guy I was trying to get into that scene. You're writing on Easy Rider. And then it feels like after 9/11, everything just changes for you as a songwriter.
Everything did change on 9/11. It did change for everything, not just songwriter, but life. We are. Why do you want to make something bad out of something good? I just got through telling you, I did not write the song with that kind of spirit. I wrote the song in the spirit of justice. I am not speaking to the entire Muslim population of the world, as you seem to be trying to infer that I am. I am not. I am speaking to the guys who bombed our trade towers, the guys who set the bomb in Boston, the people who have done the damage, the people who continue to murder people. I am terrorist. I am speaking to those people at all. And if you listen to the song, I would hope you would get that opinion. Now, I'm not speaking. I know what I wrote, son. I wrote the song in the spirit of justice, not in the spirit of putting anybody down. And I do not want you inferring that I did, because I don't.
I understand that, Charlie.
I don't think you do. What I'm talking about is there seems to have...
I agree. You're just stirring this shit up.
It seems that, like, I can draw a bit of a line between Charlie Daniels, the musician, up to a certain point and afterwards.
Listen.
Boo on CBC.
The thing that happened in Las Vegas cut me to the heart. The thing that happened on 9/11 cut me to the heart. I love people. I love America. I love my nation. I love my country. I don't see anybody trying to destroy it.
I think it was just a piece of shit, CBC. Come on.
And if I write songs about them, I am not indicting their entire religion, their entire country, their entire anything. I am only saying that the people who do this thing need to be dealt with in a very sincere way.
Charlie,
that's all I'm saying. Can't you understand that?
I hear what you're saying.
Okay, then you're not listening to me then.
I do. I hear what you're saying.
Well, what are you trying to say?
I was asking, do you ever worry that your political views would... Music can sometimes be a great unifier. Do you ever worry that your political views could keep people from your music?
I do not. No.
No, you never...
It's another stupid question.
It doesn't matter, or you don't think about it.
Honestly, this is a mess. It was a great interview up till then.
Let me tell you something.
A lot of good music.
There's a whole bunch of people out there that do, and there's a whole bunch of people out there that sympathize with it. And, you know, that's just the way it is. It's who I am. It's what I'm about. Mm-hmm. I believe in justice. I do not believe in prejudice. I do not believe in castigating people. I don't believe in doing any of the things that you seem to be inferring.
Yeah.
I do not. I don't hate anybody.
Thank you, Charlie Daniels.
Any person on this earth. I am a Christian, but I hate violence and I hate terrorists.
Well, what about this idea? Let's just talk about music for a second. Let's talk about music when you were listening to the Carter Family on a radio, you know, when you were a young man. The idea was that everybody around you was listening to the Carter Family at the same time. It was a great unifier. When you heard Elvis, when you heard Bob Dylan, when you heard all these artists, it can be a great way to bring people together. We're living in a very difficult time right now. Do you see your music fitting into this idea? Do you see music fitting into this idea that potentially it can unify a fractured people?
No. I don't think music can unify fractured people. I mean, I don't think music alone can do it. I think it takes a lot more than music.
What does it take?
It takes a change of heart is what it takes. It takes leadership. It takes a lot of things. You know what it takes.
I don't.
Well, maybe I don't either. Maybe we'll keep searching for it.
The question I'm always asking is that, you know, I'm wondering... Does music play a part in any of this?
I think you asked me a question as if it was a common denominator that could stop it. No, I don't think you can. I think combined with other things, it can help out.
Do you think about your music that way?
Do I think about my music as... I write what I feel and what I feel in America. I reflect a lot of the attitudes of the population in this country. And I am not the kind of person that thinks, well, lay down and die and let things happen to us. We've done that way too long. It's time, when it becomes time, the same thing, problem with crime. You know, it's the same people doing it over and over and over again. It's been proven. And it's like, you know, we need to deal with it. We need to deal with our situations. If my music reflects that, then it's reflecting it honestly, absolutely.
I guess maybe.
I really appreciate you talking to me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Charlie Daniels is in the Country Music Hall of Fame, a member of the Grand Ole Opry.
I guess maybe I'm an old white man, but...
His new memoir, Never Look at the Empty Seats, is out now.
I think that was a pile of shit, that CBC interview. I think it was really going well. It was interesting. But he had an agenda, and the agenda was, I'm calling you a redneck, Charlie Daniels. I'm calling you anti-Muslim, anti-black, I think he was suggesting. Well, when Charlie talked about the famous quotes of all the black-on-black violence in Chicago. I mean, what? I mean, I'm listening to CBC Radio and I'm enjoying it. Time to shut off the car. I'm here at Buffers Park, and this is the start of Dixon Jane's podcast number 655. And I thought I'd start off with that, because I knew what was coming. Charlie Daniels made his name when he played on Dylan's Nashville Skyline, which is one of my favorite ever Dylan albums. I absolutely loved that album. And the regular musicians who were coming in, it was Dylan's third Nashville album, the regular musicians, one of them couldn't make it. Charlie Daniels came in and played as best he could. And when he packed up to leave, Dylan said, "Where's that guy going? I want him." And that changed Charlie Daniels' life. So, anyway, I really do think this... I really didn't like the smell of that interview at all. Like, he had an agenda, and the agenda was, I'm going to call you out, Charlie Daniels. I'm going to stir something up here because you're in support of, you know, maybe he is an NRA. Maybe there's a lot of other facts that weren't discussed that would, you know, if I was to find out more about Charlie Daniels, I might not be in support of him. But on that particular, the way it was done, I thought it was kind of, it was cheap. Really cheap shots. Anyway, God damn it, there goes 10 minutes of the Dixon James podcast. I'm here at Bluffers Park on a very sunny, beautiful day. Once again, I should step out of the car. I will in a minute. It is, what's the date here? Wednesday, November 8th. The strike continues on at my college. There was talk today. They're going to force it to a vote. They're going to ask the staff, the teachers, to vote on the last proposal, whether to go back. And I don't know how this is going to play. All I do know is that when this gets resolved, and it is going to get resolved, instead of finishing around December 15th, we're going to be teaching into January. Students will not be able to. There'll be a very short break. And for a lot of students, especially the international ones, they go home at that time. They won't be able to. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be a mess. And trying to place it all together is just really going to be brutal. Sorry, that was the sound of messengers. It's something I want to share with you. Ah, yeah, Brian Hassett. Now, here's a connection. I got to text him back. So, look, I'm going to pause this. I'm going to come back to you because I got a lot more to say about books and stuff. So hang on while I reply to Brian Hassett, who's the guy I met in Lowell, who was the reading, goes around the country in America reading Jack Kerouac. Very nice guy. So let me deal with that, and I'll be back soon. We'll be right back. Yeah, I'm back. Been in my car, sat in the sunshine, and read for a little on my favorite little bench. It's still cool, but God, what a beautiful fall day. But I am just so consumed by these books I have. And I want to make a note of that, or point something out to you, to me. The library, like I go down now, after Lowell, I can't find the right opening. After Lowell, my interest in the beach just was kicked up another notch. It had come back in full force, you know, but it was just really taken to another level. And so to go down to my library and catalog all these books and find, I mean, up to 170 books on sort of beat related. That includes my Timothy Leary, but not so many of those. But there's a lot of books there, and a lot that I've bought and either forgotten about because I read so long ago or haven't gotten around to it. They just got picked up. And now, with my fading memory, I'll pick up a book and think, oh my God, that looks interesting. If, for instance, this one, Door Wide Open, was one of those. I don't think I ever read this. I think I just bought it. And it just means so much to me now. I have such a clearer understanding of Kerouac, the real man, not the writer. And it's different from biography. These are the letters he's writing to his lover at that time. And, of course, the sad ending of it as he gained fame. Allen Ginsberg set him up with a blind date. She met him in New York at Howard Johnson's and... you know, she was this beautiful woman who fell in love with him. And she's a very interesting character on her own. And was a writer and was writing at the same time. There's a passage here from right at the end of the book when Kerouac, he's bought his mother a house in Long Island. He's living with her. He's trying to keep people away. He'll come into the city and get drunk, but doesn't want anybody coming to visit him at this home. And his mother sort of rules the roost. And there's a very sad story of the day that she took a train out there and then another hour bus to finally get to his place. And the first thing the mother said when she opened the door, this is Kerouac's mother, Mamère, was, what train are you taking home? Like, it was very clear, and Kerouac told her, nobody can sleep here, you know. Ugh. Anyway, Here's one of his last letters to her, 1958. Joyce, when I come into New York this fall, I hope you won't get mad at me if I fiddle around with other girlfriends a little. I don't want to be steadies with anybody. Now, if this hurts you, why? Does Alan get mad when I visit Joe Blow instead of him? Don't own me. Just be my nice little blonde friend, and don't be sad because I'm a confirmed bachelor and hermit. Hard to talk about this. I guess you're sore all over again. Well, if I do fiddle around with other girls, which is really unlikely in a way, you won't know about it. You know, he's not mean to be mean, but he's, you know, wow. Anybody uses people. He certainly used this woman for more like a secretary. Like it was always when he's in Florida with his mother, continually writing letters, send me this, you know, give this letter to so-and-so, ask so-and-so about this. But she was in love with him. She took it. But so now, anyway, I've got this book. I've only got a few pages left to finish, Door Wide Open, A Beat Love Affair in Letters, and it's good. Then I went down there and I looked, oh, okay, now I've got a book edited by Brenda Knight, I guess, called Women of the Beat Generation, the writers, artists, and muses at the heart of a revolution. Now, that is fantastic. And, of course, there's a whole chapter, I just lost the page, dedicated to Joyce Johnson, this very writer, and just, you know, how important she was to this movement. It's a beautiful picture. I mean, she was a beautiful woman. Johnson gives an eyewitness account of Kerouac's catastrophic encounter with fame when On the Road became a cause celebrated in 1957 and inspired many young people around the world to identify themselves as beatniks. We see how the members of the beat generation, such as Allen Ginsberg and Leroy Jones, managed to thrive while others like Kerouac and Cohen, that was her best friend, who died by suicide, were unable to survive the seismic shift in sensibility. So that's talking about her book also that I've got here, Minor Characters, a memoir of a young woman in the 1950s in the beat orbit of Jack Kerouac. And it's just wonderful. Then I kept looking and found, oh, whoa. I picked up another book for $4 called In the Night Cafe, a novel by the author of Minor Characters, Joyce Johnson. And because she married somebody after that. And he died in a motorcycle accident. And I could see this story is about an artist, a painter. And her husband was a painter who died in a motorcycle accident. So that's on deck for further reading, all those books. But the wonderful thing is, I'm not going out and buying these right now. I'm going to my own library that I've picked up. And so I'm so grateful to Ken. I can't say I've forgotten about, but who did all this in the past, that today would have so much more meaning to me. It's as if he prepared the work and said, here, I'm going to get this one, I'm going to get this one, and we're going to build you a really nice beat library. So one day, in the fall of 2017, when you're interested in the beats again, you're going to be able to go down there and pick up all these rich resources and enjoy them like never before. And that's just fantastic for that to have happened. Anyway, I've been texting back and forth with Brian, who's doing a performance in the West End tomorrow night. I missed the one on Friday, his show, and this is another one that's going to be. This is where he's with his partner doing, it's called The Creation Zone. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Anyway, I would like to get out there to see him, but it's way the hell out in, where is it? Where is this town? Oakville. And Oakville is at least an hour drive from where I live in Scarborough. It's the other side of the city, past Toronto. But it would be nice to see him again, so we'll see on that. Anyway, I mean, again, that's just another beat connection, and that's really not of a whole lot of importance here and now, I guess. But man, oh man, having these books and these passages and the things that just resonate more, it's wonderful. Now, while I'm digesting all of this, taking it in and thinking about it, I'm also thinking daily about just writing my own story. And I don't mean it as a novel, and I don't mean it as a, you know, oh, I'm going to do a great work of art. I mean, just tell my story, the details. And it's important because there's a passage here where Kerouac's talking about Memory Babe, the book he was going to write, which turned out to be Visions of Gerard, I think, of how he's just forgetting these details of his life. You know, he knows the story, but he's forgetting the details. And I realized, man, there's so much. There's an interesting passage when he said that it's the details that are so important, you know. And I realized, yeah, that's, I got to watch it because an awful lot of the things I remember and want to talk about are there. I have a better understanding of why I want to do this. I mentioned, I guess maybe last time, that my son said, just do it, write it for yourself. And I think that is the thing, because I put these barriers, I put these problems, I put these roadblocks, I put these excuses, I put these things in the way constantly. And it's a question of just getting down and writing and not worrying about the finished product or how good it is or what people are going to say, but just record those memories in Prince George. Those are unique. Those memories in Japan, the memories up in the Yukon, the memories in, you know, just so many of the times. Just right away. Don't worry about editing, or do it the way your brain works now, which is scattered and all over the place, and let it be that way, you know? Don't worry about, oh, I was trying to frame it, an outline, and all this other stuff. No, just start writing and keep writing. So I think that's going to be my my project for 2018. I think that's, and that'll be, yeah, that'll be the time. I'll be 70. And if not then, whenever. I do have the title. I've had the title forever. And it's Waiting for Now. And it just fits just perfectly on many levels. So, okay, there, I've said enough. That's another 10 minutes gone. And, man, I'll be finished this podcast before I know it. I think I'm going to go to Girard Street near the Indian section. I don't know if it's called Little India or whatever it is. Because as in Toronto, in the East End, because there is a bar that's opened up with Japanese-style snacks and beer, a brewery, and it sounds, both my wife and I agree, it sounds awful, but we thought maybe we'd drop by there today, so that would be a nice thing. Scarborough Dude, signing off.
ਆਟੋ ਹੋਮ ਤੇ ਇਨਵੈਸਟਮੈਂਟ ਪ੍ਰਾਪਰਟੀ ਦੀ ਇੰਸ਼ੋਰੈਂਸ ਪਾਲਿਸੀ ਇੱਕ ਬਣਾ ਲਈ ਹੰਡਰਡਸ ਆਫ ਡਾਲਰਸ ਇਸ ਸਾਲ ਆਪਾਂ ਸੇਵ ਕਰਕੇ ਇੰਨਾ ਹੀ ਨਹੀਂ ਜੇ ਤੁਹਾਡੀ ਕਿਸੇ ਦੀ ਆਟੋ ਔਰ ਹੋਮ ਇੰਸ਼ੋਰੈਂਸ ਦੀ ਰਿਨਿਊਅਲ ਹੈ ਜਾਂ ਤੁਸੀਂ ਫ੍ਰੀ ਕੋਟੇਸ਼ਨ ਲੈਣੀ ਚਾਹੁੰਦੇ ਹੋ ਆਪਣੇ ਡਾਲਰ ਸੇਵ ਕਰਨ ਦੇ ਲਈ ਆਲ ਸਟੇਟ ਨਾਲ ਕੰਮ ਕਰਦੇ ਕੁਲਵਿੰਦਰ ਗਲੇਰੀਆ ਨੂੰ ਅੱਜ ਹੀ ਕਾਲ ਕਰੋ 647-2180-647-2180-0726 ਤੇ ਆਪਣੀ ਸੇਵਿੰਗਸ ਸ਼ੁਰੂ ਕਰੋ
अपनी लाइट और कार दोनों नु रोशन करो लग्जरी लाइट्स दे नाल फेस्टिव सीजन दी बहुत सारी वैरायटी ले विजिट करो स्टोर 4220 स्टील्स एवेन्यू वेस्ट वुडब्रिज विच स्टील्स और पाइन वैली दी इंटरसेक्शन फॉर इंफॉर्मेशन ली कॉल करो पपिंदर और जस 905-856-9999 905-856-9999
पिछले 30 साल तो डक्ट क्लीनिंग एसी फर्नेसर रिपेयर
या डक्ट क्लीनिंग
करके लोएस्ट प्राइस दे एसी फर्नेस इंस्टॉल करना चाहते हो अकाल डक्ट क्लीनिंग
ओह माय गॉड
अकाल डक्ट क्लीनिंग 905-890
कैन गेट अवे फ्रॉम इट ओके
प्राइस बेहतर सर्विस 905-890-0662 अकाल डक्ट क्लीनिंग
Yeah, I'll be sure to call. All right, let's change the station here. Cool. All right, push that FM button again. Let's go to the next one, which is CBC 2. When I switch cars, the button system is entirely different. Like, push this button. No, it's the same. Push this button. No, same. Ah, okay.
Radio 1, 99.1 FM in Toronto.
Let's see if we get some news we want to hear.
On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, Canadians pause to reflect and remember. CBC Radio News covers the Remembrance Day ceremony from the National War Memorial in Ottawa.
I always watch it on TV
hosts
if I'm at
their
home.
Special broadcast starting at 10:55 a.m. The Remembrance Day ceremony this morning on CBC
Radio 1. Quite moving,
One.
And you just don't see. I mean, there was a time when we
CBC News
would see
next,
veterans from World War
One.
You know.
Hey, I'm Tom.
That's
Powell.
Gone. You don't see them from World War II
where
now.
You came from, you need to leave. Sometimes your home isn't your home until you live somewhere else. Greta Gerwig talks about all these things in her new film, Lady Bird. After years as an actor, she talks about telling her own story as a director.
Now, was that Tom Powers? Was that the guy I was pissed off at yesterday for the lousy interview?
This is CBC News.
Okay, let's see what we got here.
On CBC Toronto, it is 10 o'clock. Good morning. I'm Jill Dempsey. It is 4 degrees. We expect some showers and some flurries later today.
Yeah.
The temperature goes to 9 and drops to 2 this afternoon.
First snowfall.
Record prices for Toronto condos are leaving some people deep in debt and others shut out of the market completely. But hundreds of people who did manage to put down enough money for a deposit on a condo are now finding out their dreams of home ownership have been dashed anyway.
Uh-oh.
The CBC's John Lancaster explains why.
Museum Flats was advertised as a hot new condo project in the Junction, close to transit, parks, and a new museum. But last week, more than 100 buyers got an unexpected letter in the mail. Inside, their deposits. And a note from the developer, Castle Point Numa, explaining it doesn't have financing to build the condos because of a lack of approvals and permits. Janice Creighton knew there was some risk when she put a deposit down 18 months ago, but
it was our home. I'm having a little trouble kind of letting go of the fact that...
Okay, I don't think we need to hear that. You know,
the developer says
you've got news wherever you live, wherever you're listening. This is Toronto stuff. I always... Toronto... Condos scare the hell out of me, and mostly just because of those condo fees that, you know, invariably are going to go up. They're going to be high. They're going to be like... You know, after you've paid for the bloody thing and you got all these rules, I'm just not ready for condo living. And it might suit my wife better if she was well off. But that ain't for me. And now, you know, when I've talked about, okay, maybe in a couple of years I'll get rid of our house, I'm just wishing that I could stay there till I'm an old man and, you know, ready to be carried off in a wheelbarrow. And that it could be maybe passed on to my sons, you know, something. But hey, let's not get ahead of ourselves. In fact, let's get back down to the present. I've just come back from a medical, my annual medical with Dr. Musa. And I like him, but I have never, in all my life, I have never had a medical as brief as this one. Asked me to sit up on the bed. Okay, I'm ready. You know, usually you get the bum check. Well, your prostate check, sorry. Finger up there. No, we haven't done that for a while. Basically, put on a stethoscope, listened to my heart, said, okay, we're good. And then that was it, you know, and then ran through, okay, I've gone through the blood test. Nope, sugar levels are fine. You know, we're a little worried about, when you have too much sugar. God, this brain of mine, like it just when you say, okay, retrieve the word I need, I'm halfway through a sentence, give me the word that's missing. You know, and it's not there. And, of course, it comes up when you don't need it later on. Blood pressure was fine, and everything else is okay. And I had to, you know, say, well, you know, I've got a little bit to do with, I get heartburn now in the evening. I didn't used to as much. Oh, okay, that's reflux. And, worst case, you're going to have cancer of the esophagus if it just keeps going because you got acid coming back up when it should be going down. That's because the sphincter's not as strong as it used to be. Oh, my God. Okay, that's interesting. Probably more than you want to know. But, you know, I say, well, I just take a Tums and it's fine. It's gone. Okay, as long as you can treat it like that, no problem, no worries, you know. So, like, boom, over and out. I'm in the hallway asking, well, how was your vacation? You know, and well, how are you doing? I'm trying to drag it out a little longer. But that's the way it is. Compared to another doctor I had who was very, very old school. And it is interesting because they're trained different times, different places. Medicine changes. And Dr. Musa is, you know, he's just a little more brief, but it suits me fine, you know. I told him I'm in the best mental health I've been in years, just physically. And I explained, I think, I know I'm going to go with my heart attack the way my father did. And he said, you know, he's going to go from cancer the way his mother did. And so that's just the way the world is. Okay, that's fine. Did say, do you want to go for a stress test? And I said, yeah, I think I should, but not on the treadmill. I don't think I would survive one of those. But they do, they inject something into you and it gets your heart going crazy and then they monitor it. And he said, just for peace of mind. So that's all. So there you are, an update on my personal health, stuff that I probably shouldn't be sharing with anybody, but what the hell? We're a tight group here, aren't we? The Dixon James listeners, that's you out there. Where, you know, you got to create a little bit of intimacy, a little bit of sharing, a little bit of letting your guard down. I mean, that's to me, that's why I'm such a Beat fan. These are people who bared their souls, you know, to the world, saying enough of this bullshit and phoniness and plastic people and crap. Man, oh man, I just finished Door Wide Open, and I miss it already. When you have a good book that you're into, you read, and you just want to stay with them. So I'm here. Oh, shit. I got it here. I got two books with me. I got Jack Kerouac's Desolation Angels, which is, I'm finding a bit of a slog. It's real, like, almost stream of consciousness reading. I'm up to page 82, and he's still coming down off the mountain. It begins with him up in the mountains as a fire ranger, a fire lookout guy, which is an important part to him. It's interesting because Joyce, in her book, was really worried about him having a mental breakdown up here. It really seemed as if he was cracking up. He was trying to be without alcohol and be in isolation, to be in his own. And Jack really, when it came down to it, liked to be in the bars in the city with his friends, just getting roaring drunk. And that's how we ended, sadly, you know, unfortunately. He just did not. He kept talking about living the life out in a cabin in the woods and being a solitary hermit, but his mother, you know, I think, I wouldn't say encouraged, but certainly did not discourage his drinking. She didn't want Jews and homos around, but she didn't mind him drinking till he dropped dead, sadly. And, you know, this was his problem. I know I'm going on and on and on, and most of you already know this shit, but it's just, there's a sadness to it, you know, of a guy who just was in search of so much wisdom and had such a deep understanding. There was a passage I read, and I guess I'll never find it. I don't even know where it was. I was looking. I went online, and I did, you know, Jack Kerouac top books or top 10 or something, just to see who else has gone out there and done the list. And all the ones I looked at, everyone had a different listing entirely. I think Big Sur and a couple of them might have come in around number 3, and to me that's still my favorite. But that was right at the end, or towards the end, when he really was open about how alcohol was destroying him. And he went off to Ferlinghetti's camp in some canyon and tried to get away from the bars and the adulation and the hangers-on and all of that and get his head straight, and he just wasn't able to do it. All right. Norman Mailer writes, this is on the back of Desolation Angels, and forgive me if I've already read this. Kerouac was a breath of fresh air when he came on the literary scene. Was a breath of fresh air, yeah. He was also a force, a tragedy, a triumph, and an ongoing influence. And that influence is still with us. Okay. We'll give him that. They didn't particularly like each other, but that's fine. Anyway, I guess maybe we've done enough me yammering on. I've got my little McDonald's here. I don't know why, but they're giving, it's got a, I know, it's Christmassy. The cap instead of green is a nice red, and it just looks odd. Oh, I didn't order that. But, of course, you did. I still get my senior's coffee, $1.05, one cream only. Thank you. And I'm here in Thompson Park. Not getting out of the car. It's a cool, overcast day, and they are predicting snow at the end of the day. It's going to be a big day. I am going to actually hop on a GO train and get myself all the way out to Oakville to see Brian Hassett and George Walker do their reading at the library there on the road. This is my last chance. It's their last performance this year, and I figured I just didn't want to face that one-hour drive across the 401, which just would be a nightmare. But my wife said, well, check out a train, and I can take the GO train from where I live and then catch a number 20 bus to the library and be good. So I think I'll just surprise him. I'm just going to show up. My dear wife, she started back at work today, first day back. I didn't even want to ask her when she was going back because she was enjoying this, you know, a bit of an extended holiday. But made us tempura soba last night. And, oh, man. Like, she, honestly, when she makes any dish, but in particular a Japanese dish, it is better than you get in a restaurant. I mean, there's maybe more quantity, you know, of things like she didn't just skimp on the shrimp. Just a lot of it, with an onion and other things that would just go in there and get deep fried. And then she gave me this, handed me this little treat. I got a beer. I bought some beer because she wanted one lager on her last day. And then handed me this bowl, a beautiful little dish, you know, with these deep fried shrimp and things in it, with batter, the tempura batter. And said, here's a beer snack for you. And then a bowl of tempura soba. I'll probably post a picture for this one. I do count my blessings and the fact that after 31 years, we are still together. And I picked a good one. Don't know about her, but I certainly picked a good one. All right, I guess, I don't know, maybe I've got my other book with me. I just want to read a little bit, relax, have my coffee, and just continue to enjoy the days of our lives, you know? Just this time to make the most of what time we have left. I mean, speaking of which, you know, we just heard that Remembrance Day, but it's a year ago tomorrow that we lost Bob Goyetch. And if Bob could say anything, it would be live while you're living, you know, make the most of it. Care about the ones you love. Don't hold back. Don't want to put words in Bob's mouth, but he really, really was a fine man. And I sent a note to Kat and said, I really do believe he just reached a higher level in understanding somehow. He was blessed. He was holy in his way. And it wasn't to say Bob didn't have thin skin and would be angry at certain people. And but there was just a kindness, a deep, deep kindness in Bob. I love the fact that he's bicultural, bilingual, French, English. So much so that he could just fit in either group. And his special friend, Sylvain, you know, got to spend time with him towards the end, and that was very special. But he could be just, like, tight with Sylvain and talking, you know, French-Canadian, and then just as tight with myself or any of his other friends. And just, you know, be open and a listener, and you felt you had all of Bob in that moment. A real loss. And so there is a gathering this weekend in Montreal for some. It'll be some friends of Bob and some family and others. And I hope Michael is able to make it. I haven't heard a post from him recently, but that was his plan with his wife, to get in the car and drive to Montreal. So I hope all went well for him, too. This is our friend from Northern Michigan, the virtual Uber. All right, I guess I'm going to sign out there. These are bits and pieces, but hell, this is a big piece, 16 minutes, and some of that was news. Okay, I'll get back to my books. I'm holding in my hand Women of the Beat Generation, and And I think that's what I read. It's got a foreword by Ann Waldman and an afterword by Ann Charters. She's the one who wrote one of the earlier Kerouac biographies. American Book Award winner, 1997. Holy shit, 20 years ago. But Ginsberg says, thanks for the long overdue assemblage of women of the Beat Generation. I'll read a few from here, because I do think sometimes, you know, sometimes people are just paid for bestsellers, but some of them ring true. San Francisco Chronicle, engrossing, brings a refreshing, if brutal, honesty to setting the record straight. Because the women did have a hard time, but a lot of them were as courageous, if not more so, than the men. I mean, they gave up more. They were, you know, hey, you're supposed to get married, live in a nice house, have children, and be a good housewife. That was the 1950s. And you want to go out and drink with the boys, like when I'm reading Joyce. I mean, she's out every second night to, is it the Cedar Tavern or Cedars? Or one of the places in downtown and hanging out in the bars with the boys and the artists and so on. The first time a writer has taken the trouble to really think about it and dig out women who were at the set, who were on the set at the time, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Brilliant and exciting, instrumental, and bringing about a revolution. Yeah. I'll read. Sorry. Okay, I'll just keep going. Okay. Sorry. An unprecedented exploration of the lives, writings, and secret histories of the long-overlooked women of the Beat Generation, including Joyce Johnson, who I've just been talking about, the critically acclaimed author of Minor Characters and girlfriend of Jack Kerouac, Josephine Miles, the poet and professor who gave Allen Ginsberg his start. Wow. Luann Henderson. Now, how many of you know that name? Ask yourself, does that ring a bell? Luann Henderson? The girl who went on the road with Jack and Neil. It was that young girl that Neil picked up while he was already married to what's it, Carolyn. Diane De Prima, the distinguished poet and archetypal beatnik. Joan Burrows, the intellectual playgirl who brought the Beats together. And it was shot through the head. Carolyn Cassidy, the artist and author of Off the Road, the wife of Neil Cassidy and lover of Jack Kerouac. And Ruth Weiss, a Holocaust survivor and beat jazz innovator. So, wow. What a treasure this is, and yet it is another, when I open it up and look for it, edited Brenda Knight, Women of the Beat Generation, this edition published, arrangement in Connery Press, and it looks like a first edition, copyright 1996, yeah, maybe not. Yeah, it doesn't say anything at all. You know, they have the numbers and they're running through the printings, and this goes all the way from 10 back down to 1, and usually that means this is the first printing. Because if it's a second printing, they'll usually include that. Yep. Anyway, it's even got the paper cover, which I've been reading to you from. All right. You asked for more because you don't want enough of me, and I'm just rambling on. But what I'm rambling on about is the things I care about and the thing that other people should care about, too. This is almost like a mission to me. Brenda Knight, who edited the book, The Beat Generation created an American revolution in literature and culture that transformed the mid-20th century. No doubt about that. The Beats helped make literature a democracy. Oh, there you go. Something new, something to chew on. All one needed, they believed, was passion and a love of the written word. The names of Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Neil Cassidy, William Burroughs, and their friends are well known to the reading public at large, and on its face, the Beat movement appears to have been exclusively male phenomenon. But the Beat movement's publicity did not necessarily reflect the reality of its literature and spirit. The singular book is devoted to contributions of the women and body to the body and spirit of the Beat Revolution. Now, women's lib groups and, you know, women's rights and women's equality and everybody else should be praising these things. There should be more publicity for these people. But again, the Beats, hey, man, that's 60 years ago. Who cares? Some might say. The women included in this, Melanie Brown, okay, we've done that. We know who they are. They are prose poetry. Today, now this is 1997, right? An unprecedented amount of brilliant, imaginative, and highly experimental writing by women is being recognized and applauded. Maybe Margaret Atwood is amongst those, I don't know. This anthology looks back to the antecedents of this greater liberty of expression. It is a testament to the lives of the women who helped shape the Beat era. Together, their voices form an energetic force field of consciousness. Wow. That manifested at a rich and difficult time in cultural history. Okay. So, I'll leave that. I'm going to go on and read it. Sorry, now we're up to 22 minutes. Scabbard Dude, signing out with his coffee from Thompson Park, and is just a happy camper today. And basically all is fine on the medical front, and so that's something to celebrate. Bye for now.
Come with me if you want to go to Kansas City. I'm feeling low down and blue, my heart's full of sorrow. Don't hardly know what to do. Where will I be tomorrow? Going to Kansas City, wanna go to. No, you can't make it with me. Going to Kansas City, sorry that I can't take you. When you see me coming, raise your window high. When you see me leaving, baby, hang your head and cry. I'm afraid there's nothing in this creamy, dreamy town a honky-tonky monkey woman can do. She'd only bring herself down. So long, everybody. The time has come and I must leave you. So if I don't ever see your smiling face again, make a promise you'll remember, like a Christmas day in December, that I told you all through thick and thin, on up until the end. Parker's been your friend. Don't hang your head when you see those six pretty horses pulling me. Put a $20 silver piece on my watch chain. Look at the smile on my face and sing a little song to let the world know I'm really free. Don't cry for me, 'cause I'm going to Kansas City.
Okay, I'm in the Oakville Library, and I'm standing with a gentleman who was actually one of the original pranksters, right?
That's true. Yeah, I was there day one. I was there day one, and almost every day thereafter.
So you did one of the most amazing things. You were on that trip all the way when you went from California all the way up to Millbrook, where Timothy Leary
was. I was there the day we bought the bus, and I was probably there on it every mile of that trip.
That is fabulous. And then towards the end, you were saying you stayed with Neil Cassady in Mexico for...
several times we went to Mexico, actually. The first time was right after we got back from New York. We went down to Tijuana and toured around Tijuana and that area for a day and a night. So that was one. It was kind of a half a trip to Mexico.
Yeah.
Then after that, we were doing the acid tests. And when we got done with that, Kesey had gotten busted. He'd gone to Mexico more or less hiding.
Yeah.
And after we did the LA acid tests, Babs and I and a few others took the bus down to Mexico.
Ooh.
And met Kesey in Mazatlan and went down to Manzanillo, a little town on the farther south on the coast that I'd been told would be a good refuge because it wasn't a tourist place so much as a port. And so it was cool. You know, there wasn't anybody around much.
Did the Federales give you a hard time seeing a bus like that? Was it all painted up wild at that time?
Yeah, yeah. You've seen pictures. In fact, we spent a lot of our time in Mexico painting it more. the really fine, shiny-looking stuff with the exploding grill, all that was done in Mexico while we were there. So that was like our seventh paint job or something. But we had hours and hours and days and days and days of really not much to do, either just go out to the beach or hang around the house or paint on the bus. So we painted on the bus a lot.
Now, the acid you guys are doing on this trip, you had, like, must have been clinically pure, really, really good stuff most of the time.
By that time, by the time we were in Mexico, we were using the stuff we got from Owsley. On the first trip, we were doing the stuff that my years of sleuthing have determined most probably came from Tim Leary, although not directly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, that stuff was pharmaceutically, clinically pure.
Yeah.
The stuff that Owsley made was as pure as you could get, I suppose.
Yeah.
I could detect differences. I don't know if it was his psychological makeup that he was imposing on us through this chemical, as he claimed, or if it was maybe just not quite as pure as he thought or we thought.
Our listeners
were differences.
Our listeners are going to want to read the book you've got coming in. You said maybe a February date you're open for.
That part won't be in this book. The part about Owsley and his stuff, that comes in probably 8 or 9 books down the line. I've got about a dozen books in my head right now.
And you've got a connection with the Grateful Dead, of course.
Well, yeah, I remember the day that I was at Phil's house, where I was hanging out a lot in those days in Palo Alto. And Jerry came over, and he was all excited. And said, "Hey, I came up with a great new name for the band last night. We're going to call ourselves the Grateful Dead."
Wow!
And so that was the first I heard it, but it was less than 24 hours old. So yeah, I was there from the beginning of that.
You are a piece of living history from one of the most interesting times.
Yeah, simply just by still living.
And still around.
Just the fact that I'm still alive makes me that, you know, because a lot of people didn't make it.
Yeah.
I was really fortunate. I seemed to find myself in interesting places around interesting people of all walks of life throughout my life.
Yeah.
You know, all this stuff about the Kesey and the Pranksters and the Grateful Dead, that's just like a few of the chapters of my life.
Excellent.
You know, there's all this other stuff
that's
completely different from that, where I just said, okay, I'll see you guys later, and I disappear for 8 or 10 years. And I bought a schooner, and I sailed to the South Pacific.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And you've had a lifelong passion for cars, too,
Then another time I went off to run race cars, and we ended up with our own car at the Indy 500. So, yeah, that's another whole
you
bunch
do have
stories.
A few books in you.
Yeah, that's what I'm that's saying. See what I mean?
Well, I just wanted to tease my listeners a little bit, because it is an honor to be able to meet somebody like you.
It's an honor to have people pay attention, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, some of us, the seed was planted very early in our life. Yeah. I mean, I got Kerouac when I was early 20s, and it's just stayed with me.
It's like wine. If it doesn't go rancid, some of it, just by aging, becomes more interesting. And I think that stories of that period are like that, that they have aged well and become fine wine to the people that are interested in that. And fortunately, I learned how to be a storyteller, and I've been a lot of interesting situations, and I've got a good memory.
It's a beautiful way to end this. I look forward to your performance tonight here at the Oak Ridge Library. Listen, thanks so much, George.
Yeah,
appreciate it.